welcome in to the show. It is Daniel Ortman coming to you from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. It is 8 a.m. on the East Coast. This is your 5 a.m. early riser wake-up call out on the West Coast and all time zones in between. And around the world, thanks for tuning in on this Thursday, October the 17th. Still reeling from Tuesday, not because it was a surprise. I wasn't surprised. I actually told some people earlier before the game that I felt like Canada had a legitimate shot at winning. I didn't see anything from this team and from this coaching staff that led me to believe that we were going to be able to walk into Toronto with confidence and the ability to win. Not to say that we couldn't have won or stolen the points, but I just didn't. Don't feel like all the matches leading up to Toronto had really set us up for the kind of mentality, as well as having the player selection available. I didn't feel confident, and that proved itself out on the field as the Canadians win for the first time in, 34 years, 2-0. And what is worse about this whole thing is some of the comments afterwards where Greg Berhalter rips his player saying, I didn't see the desire. I'm a big fan of leadership. I'm a big believer in leadership. I think everything rises and falls on leadership. Leaders don't throw players under the bus. Leaders look into the camera. They look into the eyes of the reporters. They address the fans, and they take ownership. They say, look, we didn't have enough good ideas. That's on me. I didn't get our team ready to play. That's on me. Leaders stand up. Leaders are accountable. Andy Stanley once said that leadership is a stewardship. It is temporary, and you're accountable. Well, I'm looking for all of those things right now. For Greg Berhalter, in the position of head coach of the U.S. Men's National Team, your stewardship of this program has not led us forward. By no objective measure can you point to any area of the program and highlight progress. As to the temporary nature of leadership, the hot seat should be really hot. The track record of the Federation, though, is to say, give him time, give him more time, especially being that, as we discussed on the show, he was the primary candidate interviewed. Everything else was a dog and pony show. And he's their darling candidate. One of the reasons, one of the allegations, one of the accusations as to why that is because his brother is the COO and, from all accounts, the de facto CEO. People are leaving U.S. Soccer House, working at U.S. Soccer House, not because they've fallen out of love with the game, but because they are tired of the toxic culture. We've seen it. We've talked about it with the Glassdoor reviews. Jay Berhalter should be on as big of a hot seat as Greg Berhalter. We have a culture problem within U.S. soccer at the highest levels. I think everything should be on the table, including president, vice president, board of directors, officers, national team coaches. We are not doing things well. If we were, we wouldn't be hit on all sides with a multitude of lawsuits, allegations of toxic culture within the work environment, handpicked candidates, nepotism. Leadership is a stewardship. I'm not seeing good stewardship from the highest levels of leadership within U.S. soccer. Leadership is temporary. Means at some point, someone else needs to step in. And for me, it's becoming more and more clear that unless those in charge take action, that they too are part of the problem. And they all need to go. And the third part of leadership is that you're accountable. And U.S. soccer and its governance and its rules, its bylaws, its policies, does everything in its power to prevent accountability from happening. They make it very difficult for accountability to happen. But accountability is exactly what we need in this moment. We need accountability. We need people to look in the mirror and say, that's on me. One of the things that that Greg Berhalter talked about in regards to his players had to do with this lack of passion. This has been a recurring theme for a while, and after the break, I'm going to get into a little bit of why I think that is, and I think there's a few reasons, and some of them may not be so obvious, some of them may be, but again, even if that's the case, if you're the head coach, that is on you. Our sponsor this half hour is DuckTick Brand, D-U-K-T-I-G brand.com. You can check them out there and pick up a journal, pick up a coaching notebook, pick up a t-shirt, and use the promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order at DuckTickBrand.com. We'll be right back after this. welcome back to the show. Thanks for tuning in on this Thursday, October the 17th. Coming up a little later in the show, we are going to be joined by Ian Thomas. He is the editor for Sports Business Journal. Getting back to where we were, talking about leadership and what Greg Berhalter, the head coach of the U.S. Men's National Team, talked about after the game, is he basically kind of threw his players under the bus, putting the blame on them, like, we just didn't play with passion. That's on him. That is, yes, the players should be accountable as well, but ultimately he's the leader. He's got to get them ready. He has to pick the right players. He has to prepare them in the right way. None of those things are happening. And for anyone who's going on air talking about he's got to adjust his tactics to his team, he's got to, this goes beyond tactics. This isn't about a formation. If you think this is just simply changing a formation and that all of a sudden we've unlocked the American spirit, please. You can repaint the walls of your room on a cruise ship, but if that cruise ship is still heading towards an iceberg or heading to the bottom of the ocean, it doesn't matter how pretty you make it, you're still going down. And so you could change the formation just like you can paint that room on a cruise ship. But until you change the culture, the leadership, doesn't matter the formation. So how do we change that? How do we get to a place where the U.S. men's national team isn't terrible? And there's no mistaking here. They're terrible. San Jose Earthquakes coach and former Argentina international Matias Almeida warned that players from the U.S. need to play like every match matters and put more passion into their game. Almeida, who moved from Liga MX club Chivas to coach the Earthquakes this season, said that the U.S. players lack, quote, passion and love, end quote, for football. Right now, winning, losing, drawing, it is all the same for them. So when that switch gets flipped, they are going to change because the league, he's referring to MLS, is growing. The United States then is going to have a great national team because they have the talent in each of their lines, many of them enough to play in Europe. Yes, the U.S. has a great team with a lot of young players with fabulous talent. But I think in this league, and especially with the players who were born here, there is spark that we have to plant within them, and that is the passion and the love for football. It's a culture problem. Winning, losing, drawing, all the same to them. Why? Because systems and structures matter. How you do what you do matters. You can try all you want to simulate competition, to simulate pressure, to simulate the environments that create world-class talent and world-class excellence. But there is no substitute for the systems and structures that create world-class talent and world-class excellence. And a part of that system and structure is a culture. Tom Beyer talks about establishing a culture at the youngest ages, and I am in complete agreement with his philosophy. There are too many kids showing up to soccer parks all over America who, if this were in an education context, would have no understanding of letters and numbers language when they showed up for school. And yet, we think that we're going to drop a kid off at practice once or twice a week, and somehow they're going to become proficient in speaking the language of soccer with their feet. It's not going to happen. The culture starts at home. A mistake I see over and over from soccer clubs across this country is a failure to educate parents of children six and under. That parent education may not seem like it's going to pay off in the beginning. You may not be able to charge a family $100 or thousands of dollars for their education. So you may not think it's worth your time if you're a pay-to-play club because you're like, we've got bills to pay. We've got other things to do, other things to worry about. We need somebody else to take care of that for us. No, it's your job. That's your community. Those are your families. Educate them. We've talked on this show about building a deep relationship with your families. This is one way you do that. And there's a payoff down the road. If you educate your parents, there's going to be a few things that happens. Number one, you're going to see less distractions on the sidelines because they're going to know what they don't know now. Secondly, you're going to have families that are more in tune with your mission and vision because you've taken the time to tell them, to teach them, to show them, to build a relationship with them. Third, if you help educate the parents and their kids and more of your kids in your club and in your program can get proficient at handling a soccer ball with their feet, at being able to control and manipulate a ball properly, those players are going to enjoy playing at a higher level for a longer amount of time. And over time, your bottom line will grow. Instead of worrying about how do we fix, this is a common question that U.S. soccer has been asking of themselves. I've sat in meeting after meeting at soccer U.S. soccer AGMs. I've listened to coaches talk about these things at coaches' conferences. And time again, you'll hear the same question. How do we address the fact that we're losing so many kids at 13 and above? This is how. You make them proficient at the ages of 2 to 6 with their feet. Now, not every kid's going to be amazing. Not every kid is going to be magical. But what you want to be able to do is get them to a place where they can read and write with their feet. If you're thinking of this in an education context, if they could add numbers, if they can multiply, if they can do basic math skills and they can read books in school, that's what we need them to be able to do in soccer. But too often, you'll see a kid at 11, 12, 13 years old, and they cannot control a ball. It's kick and chase. Everything is a struggle. Their first touch is terrible. I see kids that have incredible skill whose first touch looks like the broadside of a barn. And thus, they have to work harder and put out way more effort than they should be just to have an impact on the game because they can't settle a pass coming from a player 10 yards away. That's proficiency. Educate the parents. Personally, this is a shameless plug, and Tom didn't pay me to say this. He's been on the show. He's a friend of the show. But I think every club in America should go to every family in their club, ages 2 to 6, and buy them the book and put it in their hands. You want parent education? He's got a manual for you. It'll be the best investment you've ever made in your club. Hands down. Help your parents help your players. The other part of culture is our system and structure. Major League Soccer is not set up in a way that forces players to play under pressure. Too many teams make the playoffs. There's no promotion and relegation. In other words, there's no consequence for actions. Without consequence, there can be no real pressure. And without real pressure, we cannot create diamonds. Period. Plain and simple. The Federation and Major League Soccer for far too long have been colluding together to prop up a system that tries to simulate global football without fully embracing the system structures and cultures that made global football what it is. And without complying, without honoring solidarity payments, training compensation, promotion, relegation, and creating real pressure in this country for players, consequence for owners, we are never going to get to a place where our training environments produce players that have the passion and the hunger that Almeida is describing. It's not an accident. We're not going to magically wake up one day and all of a sudden it just starts working. The definition of insanity, we all know it, is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Major League Soccer has been trying to do soccer the American way for decades, expecting a different result, and it's not happening. It's not working. And then when you take a coach with a winning percentage under 40% from MLS, picking a lot of MLS players, it's just highlighting the fact that our system and structure and culture is not good enough. So there are things clubs can do. There are things the Federation could do. There are things Major League Soccer can do and should do. And until we do those things, we are going to be mired in mediocrity. And if we're mediocre in CONCACAF, that means we're terrible on the global stage. And we are in trouble. Our sponsor this half hour is Charity Water. If you have not ever checked out Charity Water, check them out at charitywater.org. They provide clean drinking water to people all over the world, and you can be a part of that story by helping provide clean drinking water to more and more people. Go to charitywater.org for more information. We'll be right back after this with Ian Thomas.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Or you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
Thank you.
October the 17th. We are pleased to be joined by Ian Thomas. He is the editor for Front Office Sports, and Ian is kind enough to join us on this Thursday. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing well, Dan. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks. Thanks for joining the show. Glad we could get you on. So give us a little bit of background on you. How did you get involved with journalism, sports, etc.? Where did that fascination or desire, passion, whatever, start for you that you said, hey, I want to make a career out of this?
Sure. So, yeah. So I had originally gone to school to sort of be a finance reporter. Spent some time here in New York covering commercial real estate, private equity, M&A, a few other things like that. And long story short, kind of wanted to mirror or match my interest in sort of sports and kind of my career kind of in business, writing more broadly. And an opportunity came up to work at the Sports Business Journal, which is sort of the 1,000-pound gorilla in the sports business journalism space. Had spent about 5 years there covering hockey and soccer, most broadly, more specifically, I should say, some other stuff. And then this, you know, came over here at Front Office Sports, which is a digital sports business startup where we've just gotten rolling about a little over a year ago in earnest, building out our team, kind of taking a different look at the industry, trying to get a little bit more behind the scenes and cover some stories that maybe hadn't been traditionally covered as well by the sports business space, so whether that's folks in the industry or one of the publications sort of get into it. And it's been about 6 months and I've been enjoying it so far.
So one of the big stories that I think is going to have a major effect on American sports over the next few years and decades to come is this California law that has been passed recently regarding college athletes having the opportunity to get paid. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the law and more importantly, on a broader sense, what do you think happens as a result from a cascading, aspect? Does the law, do you think we see more states adopt a similar law? Like where do you see this thing going?
Yeah. I mean, as I think everyone probably knows, this discussion on kind of whether to pay or not pay college athletes, student athletes, has sort of been festering for quite a bit here. And frankly, I don't know. I think you can make a good argument for both sides or a lot of people sort of are. You know, I think as regards to this, the California legislation, I think it's not to dodge the question a little bit, I think it's a little hard to sort of say today only because, obviously with this going to take an effect in 2023, it's hard to say if this exact form of it will. There's going to be such a fight put up by not only the NCAA and I think, other parts of the sports industry, but by the colleges themselves that might fear that this might exclude them from participating in the college football playoff. The Pac-12 obviously kind of loosely said it wasn't exactly in favor of this. I believe the exact wording they used was many unintended consequences. I think obviously this move by Gavin Newsom in California more broadly obviously is going to force the hand a little bit of the NCAA to act. I think, more and more folks have been coming out in favor of the NCAA doing something to compensate student athletes in a certain way. Obviously, the workload put on them between classes and academics is tough. The fact that other students can monetize themselves outside of school or things that they're studying obviously is a bit of a catch-22 when it comes to athletes and what they can offer them. So, I think this obviously the NCAA is going to have to act in some regard. What that exactly does, they're going to be spending millions of dollars over the next few years lobbying to alter this bill in certain ways to try to get other politicians in our states to not go the same route. Will we see kind of a windfall of states pushing the same direction? it's hard to say right now, but I think there's going to be something that comes out of this. It's, you know, as with all things, once you get kind of into that political realm, it's really hard to predict, as a lot of the back and forth will be going on behind the scenes of what anybody kind of sees, for better or worse.
If the California law is upheld and we start to see other states go down a similar path, what you know, if we kind of look in our crystal ball, let's go down that hypothetical path for a moment. If that happens and we start to see other states like, say, Texas, Alabama, you know, Ohio, Michigan, some of these states that have, you know, perennial blue blood, you know, traditional football powers, for example, in their states, where do you think, you know, how does the landscape then change for the sports landscape, if a college athlete is now, as you were just describing, able to, you know, make money off of who they are, even while at school, what kind of effect do you think that has on, let's for a second look at the professional landscape, whether that's the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, Major League Soccer. How do you think that impact affects any of their businesses, if at all? And if not, where might the impact be felt? Is it at the minor league level or the lower division level when we're looking at American soccer? Sure. You know, what do you see in that standpoint, if that happens, hypothetically, if that law is upheld and other states follow suit? What do you think we could look at in terms of potential impacts?
Well, I think, you know, probably the most impact will be felt in the sports that, you know, there's more of a traditional pipeline from top end colleges and universities to the sports themselves. So that whether that's football or basketball, you know, it's obviously NCAA baseball and NCAA soccer are both, you know, breeding grounds for players, but I would say those sports, you know, to your point, between the minor system in baseball, but also, you know, whether that's, you know, via USL or MLS academies or frankly going abroad or just other sort of higher end schools, I can't imagine those sports will see a tremendous impact in terms of their, I guess, the talent pipeline, if you will. I think, you know, basketball and football is probably where this will hit the hardest, assuming things sort of hypothetically go the direction that they go in. And I think the real sort of thing to look at is, you know, if let's say this were to pass in California and, you know, a USC, a Cal, a Stanford, the NCAA effectively declares them ineligible to compete because they have student athletes that can now make money compared to other schools. Does that mean that you would never see a UCLA in a college football playoff? Does that mean you would never see Stanford in men's or women's the March Madness? You know, by proxy, does that mean those schools recruit more poorly and the talent, you know, shifts elsewhere or goes to smaller schools? Does that mean that frankly those, you know, assets in terms of the competition level in those conferences diminish? You know, if you're an NFL coach or a scout for an NFL team and the talent level drops off in the Pac-12 because, you know, maybe there's one or two really strong schools and some others, do you look at a quarterback at Stanford or USC differently than you might have if they were a stronger division or, you know, they faced Alabama in a bowl game and played really well? All of a sudden, if that team is, you know, playing effectively lesser opponents, one, does that mean they recruit more poorly? Or two, does that mean you sort of say, well, they, you know, it'd be like looking at a quarterback from a NCAA subdivision and maybe that discounts them as well. You know, I think that's going to be, I think, the determiner of what happens here. I mean, will the NCAA find some middle ground with it where, you know, presume that if this goes past, that these schools still participate in, you know, big competitions in the conferences themselves, you know, in bowl games, things like that, or do they strip those away as sort of a, I guess, a pseudo punishment for being located this way or following those guidelines? I mean, it's hard to imagine that, you know, if this were to pass in Michigan or in Florida or California or even Texas, to your point, that all of a sudden all those schools would just not be eligible for bowl games. it's hard to imagine we get to that point, but I guess in theory, that's the big stick that the NCAA will sort of carry when it goes to local politicians and say, hey, do you want to see Michigan State ever compete for, or Michigan or Ohio State ever compete for in a bowl game ever again? If they, if you pass this, they're done. There goes, the tens of millions of dollars that your local institution makes to put back into not only sports, obviously, but other parts of the university. So, I think in terms of that talent pipeline, that part of the decision or how this will actually be enforced in relative to those schools will probably determine, how the other parts of the sport will be impacted, if you will.
When we look at the landscape of American sports and looking at the business of American sports, the NFL for quite some time has been, kind of king of the pile. They've been at the top. They're, somewhere in the ballpark, roughly of around 15 billion, give or take a few billion. I'm sure you and I can do a give or take a billion here or there in our checking account. Give or take a billion here or there, they're around 15 billion. Major League Baseball, I think, is just under 10 billion. NBA, close to around 5 billion. And then Major League Soccer is less than a billion in some numbers that I'd seen. When we look at kind of the top leagues for those sports, American football, baseball, basketball, as well as soccer, what are some things that you see where American soccer, and in particular Major League Soccer, needs to do to start to close that gap with baseball, basketball, and American football?
Sure. Well, I think, media rights is always going to be the kind of the thing that wags the tail of the league revenue dog, if you will. And I think, until we get to the point where MLS can really command those kind of deals, it's always going to pale in comparison. And, I think it's in a way, it's a bit of an unfair comparison between NFL and MLS. Let's say, for example, yes, they're both pro sports leagues in United States, North America, and presumably are the top of trying to do things in the most professional of manner in terms of growing their business and so on and so forth. But the NFL is a monolith. I don't have the data in front of me, but of the last 120 of the top rated 125 or most viewed 125 television programs of the last, I believe, calendar year or 2019 thus far, the NFL makes up upwards of 90%, if not close to 100. There was not outside of a World Cup final or when the U.S. men's national team or women's national team advances to a certain point in a World Cup, no real soccer competition can match that reach, at least here in the United States. Obviously, more globally, that's a different story. But at the end of the day, the international media markets are not paying top dollar for MLS matches as they are, say, for the NBA in some areas of the world. I think, from an MLS point of view, I think it's about driving that media value for that next deal. It's about proving that, your league is extremely relevant in certain markets, the property that you're putting on, or excuse me, the product that you're putting on the field is improving and obviously offers something to a viewer of not only a soccer fan, but just a broader sports fan. So if an MLS match is on ESPN, that's going to cause folks to turn in. I think as we both know, MLS faces challenges from every other league on the planet that also wants a piece of the United States and the United States soccer fan, which, presents a totally different challenge to that specific league as it relates to, say, the NHL and the KHL. The KHL is obviously on the radar of the most extremely hardcore hockey fan, but even so, it's not even remotely close. MLS, you know, it still struggles in terms of being the most relevant league here in the United States. I mean, frankly, if you just go strictly by television ratings, it's not even the most relevant league to the American consumer that's based in North America. I mean, Liga MX takes that crown by quite a bit, and frankly is, you know, their television ratings do far better than the EPL, granted the fact that Liga MX matches are on prime time on a Saturday versus 8 a.m. on a Saturday or Sunday morning does sway that a little bit, but nevertheless, that league is extremely popular as well. So, yeah, I think for MLS, it's just keeping to up its level of what it's doing. It's about finding those cities that I think, you know, uniquely connect to the marketplace where you're going to drive really strong local ratings, and that's what's going to be able to, they're going to be able to come to the table to their broadcast partners or potential broadcast partners in 2022 and say, here's, you know, the unique proposition we bring in terms of our sport, in terms of what we're doing. This is how it's different than, say, what you're airing MLB matches or games, excuse me, NBA or NFL. This is, you know, the demographics of where America is going. This is where we see MLS fitting in there. And then, you know, hoping that the networks that they're chatting with sort of view things the same. I mean, I don't expect that gap to close, you know, in this next deal. I think, you know, the NFL is still going to be garnering billion-dollar contracts. Its television ratings are up quite a bit compared to last year and are almost back to where they were, if not higher, in 2017, before there was a little bit of a, I guess, concern where the NFL was going in terms of a product. But, you know, I think MLS has had steady growth. I think for the league, I obviously can't speak for everyone there, but I think the progress has been good, and that's ultimately what's going to drive this up. So every time they do a new deal, if it's 20-30% higher, that's kind of what they're going to hope for.
So a question in regards to, like, for example, sure, the next TV deal. If you track the viewer numbers, and you mentioned, for example, you know, Liga MX is the most watched league here in the U.S. The Premier League follows up in second. Some of these MLS matches that are on ESPN as well as Fox, less than 100,000 viewers. The ratings have been declining over the last few years on their matches from a national broadcast level. What kind of effect do you think that's going to have on this next potential deal? And you know, knowing that right now they're splitting somewhere around $90 million per year on their current TV deal with the Federation, with the landscape of where American sports are, where their viewership numbers are, do you expect a deal in the same ballpark? Maybe a little higher, maybe a little lower, knowing kind of where the market is. What do you see as a potential coming up for this next deal, especially if the Federation is going to be bundled together with Major League Soccer in terms of, you know, seeing where the interest is and where the television numbers are in comparison to their other counterparts, you know, whether that's basketball, baseball, or American football?
Yeah, well, I would say specifically on the ratings for the league. I mean, I think, you know, more broadly, they've been increasing. I mean, there obviously have been some ebb and flow in that each year. You know, I think unfortunately this past season there's FS1, which I think a lot of the league's lower ratings have come on, or to your point, less than 100,000 viewers at times. I mean, I think that network itself has just been struggling with sports properties more broadly. I think, you know, it's been losing a lot, whether that's Bundesliga or other rights, other sort of leagues or properties that I think they're sort of repositioning reconfiguring their strategy as it relates to live sports. And even just, I think, you know, they need to sort of, they're looking a little bit at kind of the relevancy of their network as it relates to, say, an ESPN2 or something like that, where MLS ratings have been markedly higher. You know, to get to your point on kind of what this next deal looks like in a lot of ways, I mean, there's still no real indication if the U.S. Federation rights, men's and women's and friendlies, will be bundled into this deal. but I can't imagine it wouldn't, given that it probably makes more both properties' rights more valuable to a certain degree. But I think the landscape for media rights, for sports media rights, is markedly different than the last time Major League Soccer sort of was in the marketplace with these rights, or I should say Soccer United Marketing, since they're going to be the kind of the sellers of these rights. I mean, you know, just think of some of the players that have entered the space in the last, not even 2 or 3 years, whether that's DAZN, Amazon to a certain degree. There's always the thought that somehow Facebook is going to enter the rights space. I mean, Twitch has become somewhat of a player for live sports rights. ESPN through ESPN Plus has obviously been bundling up not only a ton of soccer rights, but just sports rights in general. You know, you still have other sports companies in the space. You know, you have a Turner that obviously made a big play with the Champions League. You know, you still have Fox and ESPN linear more broadly, and who knows, maybe NBC sort of finds its way in the mix if it sees synergy with some of the other properties. I think and then you have the digital players that you know, obviously Flow Sports is has troubles with DC United, but there might be some opportunities there to break up the rights a certain way. I think, you know, MLS is positioning itself in a way where not only is all of its domestic U.S. and North American rights going to be up in 2022, but so will every local team right as well as all international rights. So what does that value proposition look like to, say, an ESPN, where they have, you know, obviously rights, broadcast platforms and, you know, literally every continent, sans Antarctica, probably to a certain degree on the planet? Can they pick up a global package of MLS rights and, you know, not only, you know, have games, you know, your local matches be streamed on ESPN Plus, but they're broadcasting games on, you know, ESPN. You know, this year's MLS Cup final is going to be on ABC, which is obviously in the ESPN family of networks, I guess more broadly, if you will, the Disney family. Does that mean more games show up on the ABC platform? You know, or even how are these rights sliced and diced up to a larger degree? I mean, does a DAZN step in and own the MLS platform in Canada? I mean, a lot of these players, some of these upstart media companies or even some other ones are, you know, they're really hungry for rights and, you know, really trying to drive subscribers, whether that's to their OTT digital platform and drive subscriptions that way, or, you know, just trying to compete in this very fractured landscape. I think, you know, I don't think it's a question that MLS is going to get more money on its next deal. Will it be a 50 to 100% bump? I don't know. I mean, the last deal, if my memory is correct, went up about 30% year over year. And I think they're hopefully probably going to aim for that same ballpark if they can get it. I think the real question for MLS is going to be how much of what they do is going to be put behind a paywall on, say, an ESPN Plus, as this is a league that still, you know, in a lot of ways needs to draw more fans in. You know, doing that sort of makes a lot of sense for, say, a USL, which, you know, up until this year never had a rights fee. You know, obviously needs to work its relevance, but also needs to generate some money so it can pump some money back into its operations and building its league out and helping expand, you know, USL Championship and League One and so on and so forth. You know, for MLS that, you know, needs to take advantage of this wave of interest in the sport of soccer to continue to be relevant in the different markets that it's in, is it the right move to put its matches solely behind the paywall? I mean, DC United is a great test case for sort of what happened here. You know, they open Audi Field, they get Rooney, the popularity of the team is probably not going into the last season. It's never been as high as it, you know, in a number of years since the team was extremely relevant, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And they put their local matches behind a paywall and kind of cut off maybe in some ways that funnel of new incoming fans who might be interested, but obviously then also make a few million dollars that they've never made before. You know, ultimately Flow Sports kind of struggled with that and technical issues also in terms of reaching those fans and delivering on that promise of this is why you should pay X dollars a month. But, you know, it's that kind of balancing act of, you know, do we need to make sure we have as many games as we can on linear television so the larger audience can maybe catch on, or do we try to make some more money so that we can reinvest in what we're doing and raise our product? I think know, that's, I think, the multi-million dollar question that the folks are going to, the league office are kind of asking themselves.
When we look at the changing landscape of media, and you brought up a lot of these different streaming platforms, you know, as the technology becomes more accessible, and I lived this about 19 years ago. I used to work at a recording studio, and you know, when I first went to work there, if you wanted to do any kind of demo or album, you had to come to us. Like, you couldn't get the tools in your house without, you know, spending tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to do, you know, to get the right quality, top quality equipment. And over the course of my time there, even in that kind of 2-year period, we started to see technology put in the hands of producers, you know, the tools to be able to do a lot of this production work before they ever came to see us. And so our studio went from, you know, where we would book, you know, a month of session time with a producer and an artist to a week. And over the course of about 18 months, I mean, it was that quick when Pro Tools kind of hit the market with a sure. kind of a prosumer level entry point, it allowed these guys to say, hey, I could spend about $2,000 and have some stuff at my house. And then I don't have to spend those extra 3 weeks in the studio tracking tracks. I can just bring in the tracks and then bring in my artist, do the vocals and a mix down in a week and be done. And so I saw the impact of the shift, the technology shift on that market in particular. And I'm looking at where we are in terms of media access and content access. It's now all over the place. We have tons of options. You know, $5 here, free here, included in my cable subscription here, but they're all over the place. And as you mentioned, they're all clamoring for a piece of the pie and a way to kind of get subscribers or viewers, what have you. How do you see this landscape continuing to shake out? Are we going to see you know, anybody kind of create a position of dominance? Do you think that's what ESPN is trying to do now, or do you think this continues because the technology is so accessible? Anybody could go start a subscription platform, you know, comparatively for pretty cheap nowadays because of the access to technology. How do you see the media side of all of the sports business and covering sports shift and continue to change over the next 5 to 10 years?
Sure. Well, you know, I think ultimately to your point on kind of what ESPN is doing with ESPN Plus, at the end of the day, you know, these subscription services or OTT platforms are only going to survive if they have value to a consumer. At some point in time, the venture capital funding will run out, or the if there's a big time backer, that will drop off. You know, if people are just frankly not subscribing, or the business model doesn't find its way out. You know, I think with something like ESPN Plus, where they're going to have the rights for these number of leagues, you know, it's going to force either, you know, the consumer's hands to determine, you know, what actually do I find valuable? What am I looking for in a product? But also, you know, we'll sort of make other ones look at themselves and say, are we really giving someone something different? I think, you know, the thing I think is going to be, it's hard to predict, is how fractured these streaming services become. You know, does it own, if you're a fight fan, if you like MMA, you like boxing, does the zone fill all of those needs for you? And you're kind of, you don't care what else is on that platform. If you're a soccer fan and ESPN Plus has Bundesliga, Serie A, USL, you know, FA championship level in England, if it, you know, presumably if they renew the MLS rights, if the, you know, if they pick up another package or two, maybe it's like J League or some other soccer leagues more broadly, do you sort of say that's all I need? You know, if you're an EPL fan and that's all the soccer you care about, do you have NBC Gold and then the rest of things are relevant? You know, ditto if you're a hockey fan and, you know, between, I guess, NHL TV and NBC Gold, is that all you sort of want? You know, I think it's going to be hard for some of these streaming providers, I think, to be everything to everyone, just because at the end of the day, there's only a handful of soccer rights that are valuable. You know, I don't see the NFL command such a big rights package or rights fee from linear television companies and generally has resisted the move to go more digital outside of just sort of like, you know, Thursday night football games are on Amazon and Twitch in addition to NFL Network and maybe also simulcasted locally on a different marketplace or through a bigger provider. You know, until those, I think those real titans of the sports rights go completely digital, which I don't really see happening, I think there's going to be, people are going to have to ask themselves, you know, one, how many of these subscriptions do I actually need? And what sports or what kind of leagues do I really care about? And I think that's going to ultimately get rid of some of these players in the space in the long term, just because it's going to be hard to make that case that you're going to attract, you know, certain level of sports fan or certain soccer fans or what have you, just based off the fact that, you know, are they going to spend $6 a month to just get your one team that you have or something like that? You know, I think it's scary to say that I think eventually we're going to get to like a bundler of some of these services, which inherently we're kind of already there with a YouTube TV or PlayStation View and that sort of thing, where it's, you know, they're effectively acting as a pseudo cable package, but not really, I guess, in a sense. And, you know, do we go there? You know, I think, and then I think that to your point, to your analogy with kind of the recording industry, I think the real question that, you know, I have with a lot of these streaming services and their viability long term is, you know, do some sport team leagues look at themselves and say, hey, you know, we could be making X million dollars more if we shift to this, you know, OTT platform, but frankly, do we think the production capabilities of an NBC or ESPN or what they're going to offer us from a storytelling point of view or the quality level of analysis or commentators that they're going to have broadcast in our games, does that, you know, is that more, I mean, what's, can you put a price tag on that? I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, you know, is it, how valuable is it for MLS to have a Taylor Twellman commenting on his games versus if they were go to a different provider and, you know, you have someone that's of lesser knowledge or, you know, frankly, some of the young unsung heroes of sports television are the folks in the production truck and people who know when to change to certain shots or, you know, just to how a game is rolled out. I mean, I think, you know, there's, I'm sure anyone that enjoys watching sports on television has a particular broadcaster that they think does an extremely great job with live sports and just capturing the cinematic nature of the sport itself or how it unfolds. You know, if you go to some of these other smaller OTT platforms, are you going to get that same level of quality? And I think ultimately that will sort of maybe keep some of the big leagues on more traditional platforms or at least the platforms owned by folks that may be a little bit more familiar with or comfortable with. And maybe that kind of cannibalizes the industry as well, just because, you know, like I said, if you only have X amount of dollars to spend and you want to watch live sports, you're going to have to determine, you're going to make a determination if, you know, which of these 10, 15, 20 platforms makes the most sense for you. And the ones that just aren't getting subscribers will ultimately kind of just go the way of the dinosaur.
In terms of the kind of new wave of technology that is making it more accessible, more and more people are watching, you know, matches, clips, etc. on their phones than they are on TVs. And I think that trend's going to continue as digital and technology continues just to be more and more portable, more and more integrated into our lives. With all of that being taken into account, looking at the streaming kind of digital new wave of platforms is kind of like, you know, web 2.0, right?
Sure.
At those kind of platforms, what are business models that can be sustainable? Obviously, you have the subscription model. Are there any other models that you look at and say, hey, there's some other things that could happen that goes maybe beyond a subscription model? Because one of the things I've heard is just an aside is people kind of, you know, going, well, I really did this to not pay X amount of dollars in a cable bill, but now I'm paying $5 here, $10 here, $5 here. I'm back at my cable bill. So are there some things that some of these kind of new generation of platforms can do where maybe it's not a subscription model, it's some other model? Are you seeing any of that trend happening in that space right now?
Yeah, I mean, there are a handful of kind of companies that are trying to, I guess, what you would call that kind of freemium model. You know, one of the ones that kind of comes to mind is Pluto TV, which is owned by Viacom. It's a, you know, they run kind of ads alongside, you know, the content, or, you know, capture a lot of, I guess, what otherwise you would, content you would see on demand versus, say, you know, would be kind of in your cable package if you went to like your on demand or stuff that would just be stagnant in Netflix. I mean, I think the challenge on that is sort of, you know, do they see themselves as enough of a live rights driver as to pay the fees that other, you know, places that are going to live and die based on which rights they have to sort of make that guess, you know, fill that gap, you know. Does Netflix ever look to acquire the live rights of the NFL? Would, you know, is Netflix or, you know, or any sports for that matter? You know, I don't know. I mean, for some of these other players, I think that, you know, are moving away from subscription fees or trying to find other ways to monetize. I think, you know, other sports folks in sports kind of look to them as places to put content. You know, Pluto TV, for example. You know, MLS has a channel on Pluto TV, which basically plays clips from old games or top 10 goals or some of the content that the league is producing on its website. And I think, you know, as it relates to your point on kind of like where those shake out, I mean, I think that's the leagues will start to look a little bit more at ways that they can just bolster all of that other content they're doing. And I think in a lot of ways for especially younger sports fans, some of that content increases their fandom more than sitting down and watching a live game. I mean, I think the challenge for a lot of these leagues is to get, you know, that 8 to 10 year old right now, that for them, their fandom of, say, Steph Curry comes from them going on Instagram and seeing him doing something cool, following his life on Facebook, Twitter, social media, or, you know, finding gifs of him doing cool stuff or just watching highlight packages. I mean, I don't, you know, I think it's a big question if the younger generation of today is going to sit through a 3+ hour game of any sport, let alone the NFL or anything like that, where, you know, what's ultimately that the live game strategy going forward? Or can you supplement that through these kind of clips, bites, monetizing these, you know, more personality driven kind of free social platforms? And does that still make someone a fan of those sports? I think that, you know, it's kind of an existential question that I think all leagues are kind of facing themselves is, you know, baseball probably chief among all is, you know, do people have the appetite to just sit through a game, not even just in person live in the stadium, but and sit there and watch it on TV? And if they're not going to do that, how do you create content around those things that are happening in those 2-3 hours? And monetize that in some way? Can, you know, just Twitter pay for a highlights package or things like that? I think that's there's a lot going on in this next cycle of media rights in terms of shifting consumer desires and what they actually want. And I think that's a big part of it too.
Well, Ian, I appreciate you joining the show. It's been a fascinating conversation, just looking at some different options of where we are in the digital media platform and also American sports at large. How can people connect with you, connect with your work, and learn more about what you guys do there and in your covering of sports here in the U.S. and quite frankly, around the world?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at by Ian Thomas, front office sports. Check us out. We have a daily newsletter that's free. No subscription model there for us. So if folks want to consume some sports business content, we have stories on our website and our morning newsletter that hopefully will fill you up with any sort of interesting sports business storylines. And I think as our conversations sort of intertwine, I mean, when you think about the growth of all these leagues, yeah, you know, what Carlos Vela does on the field is exciting and means a lot for MLS. But, you know, in a lot of ways, some of the business storylines that are happening off of it are just as important to their growth as some of the players that are on it. And frankly, to some of the players, as you think about, you know, the next MLS CBA, those business factors are going to be really important in shaping those leagues. So I'd encourage everyone that's interested in sports to check out Front Office Sports and, you know, further inform themselves on kind of the things that are happening in sports beyond the box score.
Fantastic. Well, Ian, I appreciate you joining the show and spending some time with us. We look forward to having you back on again soon and get into some more topics and subjects as well. So thanks for joining us. Appreciate you coming on the show today.
Anytime, Dan. Keep up the good work. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. That is Ian Thomas. I really appreciate him coming on. He is the editor of Front Office Sports. Appreciate his time sharing his ideas about what he's seeing in the landscape of soccer, sports, business, etc. As always, you can watch the show on facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. You can also catch me on Twitter or Instagram at Daniel Workman. Hope you have a great day. We'll see you again tomorrow.